I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
'20 was already forecast to be a very windy political year in Georgia, and then Johnny Isaacson's resignation announcement guaranteed it'll be a Category 5. There's also a continuing storm over the hazardous emissions at a Cobb County chemical plant, and it hasn't been exactly calm at Atlanta's City Hall either. Much to dive into in this edition of The Political Breakfast. Welcome. I'm Dennis O'Hare, and we finally have both of our regulars here at the same time. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, public affairs and government consultant, and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, a communications consultant, and former Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Hey, guys, great to have you back together.
Oh, man, it's been a hot summer, and I haven't seen Theron on this in this room in a long time.
You know, some of us actually had to stay here and work and not be all in Iowa at the fairs and stuff, you know. But it's good to be back with my buddy.
Before we get into what happens next following the resignation of Johnny Isaacson or his resignation announcement, we should spend just a minute or two reflecting on the remarkable career of Senator Johnny Isaacson and what he still might do in the Senate now that he is kind of free of any kind of re-election considerations. Brian, how does he take advantage of these final months, and is he able to accomplish anything in a Senate that's gridlocked anyway?
It's hard to accomplish anything in the best of times in the U.S. Congress on either side. One thing that I'm going to be looking at as far as him being freed from political considerations is he's been more willing than most Republicans to express where he has daylight between him and President Trump. And
although he picks his spots.
He's very, very judicious. So it'll be interesting to see if he speaks out on some of the things like the ongoing trade wars. I mean, Johnny's more of an old mainline Republican who's a free trader. Does this free him up to talk about the impact of tariffs on Georgia farmers, for example, or Georgia manufacturing?
But I don't know. Purdue's involved in that, too, because Sonny Perdue, former governor, is the Secretary of Agriculture. David Perdue, the other senator from Georgia, a key ally of President Trump, both of them are in an interesting position when it comes to that because of the effect on farmers that you just mentioned.
They are in an interesting position, but they do have to consider political ramifications in a way that Johnny doesn't. So it'll be interesting to see how he chooses to use this pulpit. That said, Johnny Isaacson is not the kind of person who's going to be like, oh, I'm free to just go bonkers now and just say whatever's been on my mind, all the things that I wanted to get off my chest. He's not going to do that. That's not who he is. And you're going to see him, for the most part, go out being the statesman that he's been over the last 40 years.
You know, I want to say this not just as a Democrat, but more importantly as a Georgian, you know, someone who has known for a long time the great service that Senator Johnny Isaacson for over 20 years has given. And I think the one thing that Brian just said that is so important, Dennis, is that he's a true champion for conservative causes. Now, be that as it may, I do think that we would be remiss on this podcast to not talk about some of the things that I think that drove him beyond his illness to say, hey, I want to do the respectful thing. I want to let my Republican governor and Republican leadership have an opportunity to take some months to figure out who they want my replacement to be. If you really look at his statement, Dennis, I mean, he did not want to retire. But I think after the fall and the broken ribs, if you just go back to what he said, he truly wants to continue to serve. He's a statesman, as Brian mentioned. But I do think that the the rhetoric and the things that President Trump is doing, I think it really bothered him. You know, he decided to retire, which was so honorable, and give people an opportunity to figure out who his successor, he or she, is going to be. And I'll tell you, whoever goes on to win that seat will never be able to fill the shoes of Johnny Isaacson. And lastly, I agree with Brian. I don't think you're going to see this sort of wild and unhinged, you know, senator. I mean, that's just not his style. I do think, though, that there are some Democrats reaching out to him and saying, hey, Senator Isaacson, you know, there's been some bills that I've been kind of working on, some initiatives that in the past you couldn't really publicly be that, you know, involved. You're kind of on your way out. Wouldn't it be nice to do X, Y, and Z? So I do think you're going to see some of the Democratic senators sort of lean on some of their bipartisan relationship with him.
Interesting.
I do have one or two thoughts of my own because I've covered him for so long. And it relates to this podcast, actually. Many years ago, after he lost the governor's race to Zell Miller, so this would be 1990, 1991, I was doing a program on WGST, and Johnny Isaacson was between jobs at the time, and so was former Democratic State Representative Kathy Steinberg, who had run, I think, for Congress, if I'm not mistaken, and lost in the primary. So they were both between jobs, and on the show that I was doing then, I brought them both on periodically to talk politics. It was kind of a precursor to the political breakfast. And they were not only knowledgeable, of course, they were hilarious.
Yeah.
And that was one of my fondest memories of covering Johnny Isaacson, was that little space of time where he and Kathy Steinberg were doing kind of what you guys are doing.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll get the U.S. Senate appointment.
I hear you're on the short list.
Yeah, I'm on the list.
Oh, that would be great, man.
But before we do that, let's take a look at the strategies now for both parties. Governor Kemp's going to pick a Republican, Brian, to succeed Senator Isaacson. But, Brian, does that mean that once he does that, that the other Republicans that have been lining up to take the job have to live with whoever the governor selects? I mean, they could run against the new senator in the special election next year, which has no primary. It's everybody at once.
That's true. It's going to be what they call a jungle primary, which is what you have in a special election. I don't think that any mainstream, legitimate Republican is going to get in there and basically primary Governor Kemp's choice. Governor Kemp's Republican choice is going to have a pretty straight line in 2020 in that election. Now, what we don't know is, are there going to be a multitude of Democrats getting in? Even that doesn't seem likely because you don't have a huge list running for the race we already had, the race against the incumbent Senator Perdue.
But the dynamics are different. In the race to take on Senator Perdue, there's a Democratic primary. So you have to appeal to a group of voters, a smaller group, and probably a more ideologically polarized group. Whereas free-for-all special election, you have a much bigger block of voters, much more ideologically diverse on the Democratic side. So you could see some candidates in that race that you wouldn't see in the race for the Perdue seat.
That is absolutely true, and I would defer to Theron on how that breakdown would go. Obviously, the candidates you've got running against Senator Perdue have been making an appeal to the left side of the party, and so more of the older brand may have a better shot at taking on this open seat because in a jungle primary, and this is, look, I am a fan of jungle primaries, period, as a way of taking away the power from the extremes of both parties and having more centrist candidates. I'm a believer in it.
This is probably going to be the most important decision that Governor Kemp is going to make politically since he's become governor. He's going to have to make a pick for a person who is going to be loyal to him and, more importantly, that knows Washington and that can be elected and reelected, right?
And run with him in 2022.
You finished my sentence. So you got to believe that his team is looking at all four of those phases. For Perdue, it presents a challenge because now Perdue, who has been a Trump loyalist, who hasn't really had to say anything too much because he doesn't have a primary opponent, I think he's going to be very much involved in who this person, he or she, may be. It could be a minority candidate. You know, I said recently on television, and I put some pressure on the conservatives that I was on the show with to say, why wouldn't an African-American or Hispanic or an Asian person be considered for the nomination of the Republican slot to fulfill the unexpired term of Johnny Isaacson? There are many qualified white women out there. We hear a lot of Republicans talking about the suburban woman problem. Well, mm-hmm. one of the ways to fix that is to support, put a woman in that position. But David Perdue's got to think about, okay, this person in this quote-unquote jungle primary, he or she is going to kind of be running with me on this ticket. And I think that what Brian just said, and it's very brave of him to say that, it's a possibility that whoever Brian Kemp's pick is may actually have more Republicans jump in there. Like, I don't think there's going to just be one declared Republican in that race. So let's move to the Democrats. You know, we have a history in Georgia for making things more complex on the Democratic side than it needs to be. Here's the formula. We know we got right now three, I believe, qualified candidates who want to engage in a Democratic primary to go on to be the nominee to face David Perdue. All three of those candidates have said they're not switching. So the same challenge that David Perdue has is a good challenge for Democrats. What is our formula of winning in a state? What has worked in the past? What has worked in the past is that you have a ticket, you have candidates that can pull certain sectors of the electorate in Georgia. So we got enough white candidates, right? What's missing is who is out there that can generate the excitement that we've seen from President Obama, the excitement that we've seen from Stacey Abrams in the minority community. Why not seriously have a conversation about another person? And if that person happens to be white, I'm all for it. But I think that the DeKalb County CEO, Michael Thurman, based on his appeal to motivate African-Americans, he doesn't scare white people, i.e. moderate Republicans. He has a tremendous appeal to independents. And he's run statewide successful, so he doesn't need as much money for name recognition. I truly believe if you pair him up with someone else who's going to come out as primary and run those two individuals as a ticket, then I think what we're going to see is a tremendous amount of people turning out. And let's not forget, we also have President Trump on the ticket then as well. But the other challenge that Democrats in Georgia do not have control over is who the Democratic nominee is going to be for president. Let's just hypothetically say it's Joe Biden. Let's just hypothetically say it's Cory Booker. Let's hypothetically say that it's Elizabeth Warren. I believe that all three of those are a nominee that whoever these Senate candidates are can kind of run beside. But if we, the Democrats, nominate a far left, you know, sort of nominee where Brian and all the Republicans and call them a socialist, that may be a little bit more difficult. So I just say to the Democrats who are listening, if you got credible people out here that fit that model, that coalition, where you can have someone go into suburban areas, into rural areas, can drive out the base plus strategy that we want to put in place, don't scare, you know, white Republicans too much. Because the other thing we want to put out for our listeners is that Republicans and Democrat can vote for this person in the open Isaacson seat in November. So you just can't have a base strategy.
Excellent point. Excellent point. Thank you.
Yeah.
No, that's a great point. Because people aren't thinking about that. It's a different strategy than it is in the Perdue race.
Right. It's a totally different strategy. And so that's why, you know, now look, let me be clear. There are some other people out there. Brian's new best friend, John Ossoff. You got State Senator Jen Jordan, who's out there.
Mm-hmm. Who says she doesn't want to run.
Who says she doesn't want to run, but there's a push. Look, hey, they're even trying to resurrect Michelle Nunn.
And you have African
Congresswoman Lucy McBath, who is
Reverend Raphael Warnock.
Yeah.
You've got State Senator Nakima Williams, who's the chairman of the party.
But again, if we know that the Perdue strategy is different than the Isaacson strategy, I just believe, and I'm biased, and I'll say that for folks who listen, that I believe that now is not the time to let emotions get in the way. Let's put a poll out there. Let's look at everyone's qualifications. Let's see what people can do. And let's, you know, figure it out. But I do think that the person who emerges on the Isaacson seat, along with the person who is the Democrat nominee with Perdue, is really good. And then to Brian's point, January 5th could really determine the power of the Senate. If Democrats are able to pick up maybe one or two or three seats
elsewhere in the country,
Georgia could be the deciding balance of power in the Senate.
Brian, real quickly, do the Republicans have to have different strategies, too, for these two Senate races, especially since David Perdue's an incumbent and is going to have a lot of money to start with, whereas the person selected by the governor, while an incumbent, would be a brand new incumbent and will be facing all sorts of money coming in from the Democratic side.
I don't think this changes David Perdue's strategy at all. He's still in a traditional race. You know, the Democrat has to get through a primary that will pull that Democrat nominee farther to the left than what you would want going into a general election. Where this is going to impact David Perdue is it could slice into the amount of money pouring into the state on his behalf. That said, I don't know that it matters because we are so polarized and tribal in our voting now that anybody who votes for Trump is going to vote for Perdue, and anybody who votes for Perdue is going to vote for Trump. For the most part, there may be Perdue may outperform Trump by a small amount, but I don't know that he will. I think that they will closely track each other.
But what about for the Isaacson seat? Does the strategy have to be different for Governor Kemp and the Republicans?
Yes, it's got to be different because of the points that Theron laid out that you're going to have. It's not going to be mano a mano. There will be multiple candidates in this. Now, I said that there won't be other Republicans. Theron said there will. Let me clarify. I don't think that there's going to be a serious Republican that challenges Kemp's appointee. There may be some gadfly, somebody who's unhappy with the guy who gets appointed. Generally, those come from the right and from some sort of the extremes of the party. That's possible, and that could definitely throw this into a runoff. I think that Michael Thurman would be a strong candidate for the Democrats. But if someone like him, and there are not, I think Theron would agree with me, there aren't many Democrats in Georgia today outside of maybe John Lewis who have the profile that Michael Thurman has. But if not Thurman or someone of that stratosphere, and there are not many, the strategy for in that race for the Democrats still has to be hard left. Stacey Abrams proved that is the pathway to for Democrats. It's not the old be a centrist and get this affected moderate Republicans. It is hard left and be anti-Trump. That's what they've got to be. And so that's a strategic choice that they have to make. And I think only a few Democrats can do the moderate approach to appeal to white Republican moderates.
And still energize the base.
Yeah. Thurman can probably do it. Because he's also just got the character, the personality. He's got an electric speech giver. You know, he's got some presence. And that's something that Kemp's going to have to consider on the Republican side. He can't just pick somebody who's going to be a great legislator. He's got to pick somebody who's going to have a built-in Republican base, a built-in fundraising network, and is not only going to be a good senator and partner for David Perdue, but also is a great campaigner. I think that the list of people that meet those criteria is very small.
On another subject involving the governor, Governor Kemp has told agency heads to ignore requests from state lawmakers to talk to them about the spending cuts that he ordered. 4% for their budgets for the rest of the fiscal year that ends on the last day of next June, and 6% for fiscal 2021. So as of October 1st, some of these cuts go into effect at state agencies. And Brian, for someone who came through the legislature, the governor seems to have adjusted pretty quickly to the power of the executive.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Georgia is a strong governor constitutional system, as I think we discussed the last time we were on. So Governor Kemp has tremendous leeway. He has a unique power that other governors, that many other governors don't have, and that is the ability to set the revenue projection. That is a huge power, and the General Assembly has to go along with the number that he presents
them. Yeah, because
the
budget's based on that.
The budget is based on that. And, you know, look, he's got to be careful in how he manages that relationship because the General Assembly can still go in and strip out his priorities. They can make it difficult for him to get what he wants. They still have some levers of power. But the governor of Georgia has a major say over how the budget is created and much more so than his peers across the country.
And looming through this, Theron, is Obamacare open enrollment, which is less than 2 months away. The governor had promised to come up with a waiver plan to get the state some more federal funding to cover some of these Medicaid costs. So where is that? And are Democrats watching how the governor implements these budget cuts?
There's still time for the governor to fulfill his promise about a waiver structure for Medicaid challenges that we have in his state. I think you're right. It's got to be calculated into these cuts that he sort of asked for. But when making these sort of suggested cuts and really putting the onus on his department heads to really find 4%, in some cases 2%, where we can sort of make state government leaner, he's got to be very careful to make sure that he's not weakening certain departments. At the top of that list, with all the stuff that's going on with Sterigenics and others, you got to make sure that you give the Georgians the comfort that your EPD, your
Environmental Protection Division and
which,
we're going to get into that a little bit later, but yeah, go ahead with the funding.
Yeah, but make sure they're funded, because I'm only reporting what they said, which is they knew that in a sort of a lack of immediate response to Sterigenics, it was around budget issues. The next thing is public safety. This is a governor who campaigned very, very specific on working with different law enforcement across the state, particularly working with Attorney General Chris Carr, to really combat this gang problem that we have. So make sure that in a time where you're really making government leaner, that you are not weakening things like public health, public safety, and more importantly, the Environmental Protection Division, which a lot of us depend on every single day. I do agree with Brian that what's very interesting now is how he maneuvers this through the legislature. And the one thing that the governor did very early on, and got to give Governor Deal credit because he did this when he got there, is that they strategically picked who their floor leaders were going to be. These are men and women who can get things done. And I think they're having robust conversations with them, say, okay, once these cuts are suggested and they're made, how do I sell them in the legislature to make sure that there's no sort of backlash for people to come in? Now, what Democrats are going to do is what any minority party is going to do, right? And I'm already kind of giving the Republicans a heads up. They're going to talk about public safety. They're going to talk about public health. They're going to talk about the environment. They're going to talk about certain key departments that they need to kind of push their minority party agenda. So I think in making these cuts, there's a political messaging around it to ensure that Georgians know exactly where these cuts are being made and why they're being made.
Going to need a quick yes or no from you guys on this. Does this open the door to something that a study committee has been working on, gambling, expanding some form of gambling in the state? Casinos, horses, combination, who knows?
You know, I got to commend Speaker Ralston for, in a very Speaker Ralston type way, of saying, okay, Governor Kemp, you want to suggest some cuts and push people to really look deep and long inside their departments and see if there's something there? We got to have a conversation about an alternative revenue stream. And so he put together this study committee, a bipartisan study committee. I think Ron Stevens in Savannah is chairing it, who's been
an advocate from the beginning for some form of gambling.
And, you know, one of the things, I don't know if you guys have been experiencing this, but, and I want to be fully disclosed, I do not represent now MGM International, who was looking to put a destination resort casino in Georgia. But I've been hearing more about sports betting. And if you look at some of these sports channels, which I've been doing a lot lately, thank God football is back. I mean, you actually will see sort of a ticker at the bottom. You'll see on the left panel of your TV, like the spreads.
You'll see the odds and everything.
Yeah. So I think there's been some states that have actually implemented sports betting. And it's really going to be interesting to see how much revenue has it generated and how has it been regulated effectively in the state.
Brian, does the combination of revenue and budget cuts and politics equal a better chance for gambling in the legislature come this next session?
The numbers in polling for gambling have been there for some time now. And you have a rump group of Republicans in the General Assembly who have been willing to just step out. The problem that we've had in getting it over the finish line is to get a constitutional amendment passed, which most of these endeavors would require, takes a two-thirds majority in both. That's a really high bar to get over. And so your opponents have a tremendous amount of power in stopping it. And that's what you've seen. They've been able to stop it and really even keep it from getting out of the floor, because members, even those who are for it, don't want to have to be on the record one way or the other if it's not going to pass anyway.
So to coin a phrase, what do you think the odds are?
Well, I think they're getting better every year. It's going to happen here eventually. It's just a matter of when. And it's going to be a matter of how it is structured. As Farron said, sports betting is emerging as a big thing. You're going to see the Hawks, the Braves, the Falcons, maybe the Dream, I don't know, step out and Atlanta United step out and say, this is a big part of the business industry of sports now, and this is part of how we engage consumers who are more and more staying home to watch on TV because of the high quality of that picture and the expense. Gambling is a way to get people in there and to get them engaged and excited, and it'll close some budget gaps. One thing you're going to have to watch, though, is in the past we've always said, you know, filling the holes in Hope Scholarship. Today, a lot of these rural legislators that you need, they want to see that money going toward rural health care and keeping their hospitals open.
And two things. One, which I think gets bipartisan support, is basically giving the constitutional amendment ability to the voters, right? So giving the voters an opportunity to vote on the referendum. But secondly, there's a little different caveat here now, and I'm going to have to pick on Brian for a second. You know, when I was on the other side as a lobbyist trying to get MGM and Wynn and all these big casinos, you know, Chairman State Senator Brandon Beach has been pushing for horse racing. It was always, hey, you know, we got a governor in the governor's mansion who either him, his wife, or his chief of staff just don't really have a big appetite for gambling, right? Now we have a new governor. And not a thing against Governor Deal. You know, I support him and his moral values and his core beliefs. But now I believe you're seeing the talks, because we really don't truly know where Governor Kemp is. We knew very early on this was not something that Governor Deal was going to go out and help you get past. But now we just need a signal. Let's see what Governor Kemp is on this whole issue.
So to quote another phrase, he hasn't shown his cards
yet. He hasn't shown his cards yet.
But yeah, you know, but he's covering his political bases by saying, hey, look, I'm against expanded gambling, but a constitutional amendment doesn't come to the governor, so they don't need me. So it's a politically
good
out for him.
But the implementing legislation, once a constitutional amendment is passed, the legislation to make it actually happen would go to the governor. And
that'll Kemp would do the same thing that Deal said. Deal said, if the constitutional amendment passes, I'll sign implementing legislation because I know the people are for it.
And speaking of the governor, there was more information about that medical sterilization plant in Cobb County and what the governor knew and didn't know about some of the things that were going on there. That and more coming up when the Political Breakfast continues. Stay right here.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And we are back with the Political Breakfast. Thanks for hanging out with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare with Republican strategist Brian Robinson and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson. Gentlemen, we are learning more in the last couple of weeks about the medical sterilization plant, Sterigenics, in Cobb County, which apparently admitted levels of ethylene oxide, a potential cancer causer, that posed an elevated risk of cancer in nearby neighborhoods. Now, state emergency teams went to the Sterigenics plant this past Tuesday after a gas leak last month forced an evacuation. The leak happened a day after a contentious community meeting. State officials said the company didn't tell them about it, and it turns out that Governor Kemp didn't hear about it either when Sterigenics officials met with him and he said nice things about them.
And I think that the governor and EPD, along with conjunction with EPA, gave Sterigenics the benefit of a doubt. And he was very methodical to say, you know what, we're going to do town hall meetings. And I want to be very clear, the governor's office participated in town hall meetings that were originally suggested by the local folks. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
he wasn't there, but his staff was.
Yeah, his staff was there. But as Brian just said, look, the governor's office ways of, you know, they yield a lot of power. And he was very, very, I think, neutral, very supportive of Sterigenics, wanted to make sure this company had a fair shot. But when it came out that basically Sterigenics lied to the governor, was not transparent, and more importantly, at a time where EPD was going to put in a sort of independent monitoring system to make sure that Sterigenics was doing what they were supposed to do, they failed to disclose information that came out month or two later. So I think where I am as a Georgian, because it affects us all, the bottom line is this. If you don't shut the place down, then you got to make sure.
At least temporarily.
At least temporarily. I think there needs to be a shutdown and give them an opportunity to reboot, to really figure out how they can work with the state agencies and the federal agencies to ensure that the public has faith in this company. If they're not willing to do that, then I think the governor's office and everyone involved have got to really look long and hard about how they continue to monitor this chaos.
Brian, we talked about the governor's power as the executive just a little while ago when we were talking about the budget. He had the power to say, I'm going to shut this plant down temporarily while we see what's going on. He specifically ruled it out, but at the time, he didn't know everything that was happening. If you're the governor and you feel like either they weren't transparent or even that you've been played by Sterigenics, do you turn around and say, okay, I've got the power?
The best thing that's happened for Sterigenics in the last week and a half is Dorian, who has taken a tremendous amount of attention away from their plant in the media and for the governor himself. So this is a time when, for public appearances purposes, Kemp needs to have all focus, all eyes, all comments about this hurricane and seeing that through and then handling any recovery that might ensue. Once that is over, if they come back to this, if I'm Sterigenics, I am going to be falling all over myself to be in front of Governor Kemp and do whatever he wants. Because as I said 2 weeks ago on this podcast, the politically easy thing to do is to drop the hammer, is to be the populist who goes out there battling against big business and who are hurting communities and families. That's what the Democrats have had the luxury of doing. Kemp had to take a more measured approach that to protect jobs, to be respectful of industry in Georgia, and maintain our business climate. He had a lot of things to balance. And if you take away his incentives to help you, you're in a bad spot.
Politically, does environment and industry and its environmental impact become a bigger, not just in terms of Sterigenics, but because of this, does this become a bigger election issue than it's been in election cycles past, or are there just too many other things going on by the time we get to 2020?
It's going to depend on, as Brian just laid out, how does the governor's office, in conjunction with the local jurisdictions and the state senators and state reps who represent the areas and the constituents who are being affected.
Many of whom are Democrats.
Many of whom are Democrats. And so I think if he handles it and it comes up with a solution, whether it's shut it down temporarily, shut it down long term, or give the people of Georgia confidence that the self-monitoring and the self-reporting is transparent and is accurate, then maybe not. But if any of those two, three things don't happen successfully, I do believe that you'll see some folks, not only campaigning will come up in his election in 22, but I think it will be at the forefront in some of these metro areas in 2020.
It's hard to say because the news cycle just moves so fast these days, and so much of our elections are nationalized that the local issues that used to drive things, the Tip O'Neill comment that all politics is local, that's really not so true anymore. And so I think in 2020, the issue is going to be Donald Trump, pro or anti, and that's going to drive almost everything. Now, if something blows up or there's a continuing story and somebody really screws up and there are stories of people getting cancer or other illnesses or a baby dying, something like that, that would change things. But if we had the status quo, I think it's not going to be a major issue.
Speaking of local, at Atlanta's City Hall, the director of contract compliance, Larry Scott, resigned at the end of August. About a week later, he pled guilty to federal charges of wire fraud and filing false tax returns. This is the sixth guilty plea in the federal probe of corruption at City Hall. In this case, the feds charge he didn't disclose a side job he had with a firm that helps companies get government contracts, including with the city. In other words, directly related to his job. Now, Theron, Mr. Scott was a Reid administration appointee, but he has stayed on through the Bottoms administration. So this can't be a good moment for her as she tries to move past the legacy of the previous administration.
Oh, this is horrible. To be the person in the position to help fair and proper relationships with minority businesses who have done everything that they want to do properly, have gone through all the checks to get their certification, who want to do legitimate business with the city.
But to have female and minority contractors, that was sort of his area.
Right. And listen, you know, one of the things that you would hear from the people who are anti-city government and particularly anti-Mayor Bottoms, they would say, oh, you know, the procurement process is bad. The minority participation is corrupt. And so Mayor Bottoms has done a tremendous job of coming in, you know, revamping the procurement process And for our listeners, I just want to talk about the role of contract and compliances, because there's been some misinformation out there. Contract and compliance is put in place to make sure that the city government in its procurement process is compliant with how they usher in the contracts, making sure that if there's prime companies that want to partner up in joint ventures, or if there's a contract in RFP that requires you to have minority businesses.
RFP is request for proposal.
This office was there to facilitate that. And I had heard that Mr. Scott was doing a good job of that. He was advocating for businesses who want to do legitimate business with the city, do that. But then the thing that's just so baffling to me about this, Dennis, is it's clear he pled guilty to falsifying his tax returns, so he did not disclose to income. But even if you were doing that, once upon a time, before you were elevated to be the head of contract and compliance, then I think you've got to have the intelligence and the ethical fiber to say, okay, you know what? It may not be good for me to be affiliated with a company with what has got going on. And then more importantly, I shouldn't be taking money from this company that is now taking money from other folks to try to help get an audience with him to try to, you know, do business legitimately with the city. So,
but for the mayor, I can imagine members of the city council saying, how come you didn't know this was going on?
Well, let's be fair on that. Look, the mayor can't know everything. And let's not forget, this is a mayor who came in and asked for everyone's resignation. So many of us applauded her for that. Some folks thought it didn't go far enough. Clearly, majority of folks who she thought that she wanted to serve in her administration, she kept on. I definitely think that if the mayor had known that Mrs. Scott was doing what he's pled guilty to doing, yeah, he would have been definitely terminated a long time ago. And so to be fair to her, she made a political and fundamental decision to keep some folks on from the Reid administration. There are more good people who are doing good work in City Hall that she kept on. But unfortunately, the media and others are not going to want to talk about that, because you do have a few individuals who have now, as you just talked about, has either pled guilty or have gone to jail. I think it's a couple, not a few, under her. A
couple dozen.
a couple under her administration. And so I think now the mayor has a unique opportunity to say, all right, I'm going to really make sure that this is not something that is going to be tolerated under Bottoms administration. And quite frankly, I think that she's got to probably do a reset and sort of have some tough conversations with other members of her cabinet to really investigate, like, are you, because what the law is that you can have a second job as a city employee. And as long as
But it can't have anything to do with your job
right,
with the city.
Number one. And then number two, if you disclose it, that's fine. And I think it's a limit of how much you can receive from that second job. And so part of this whole scandal is that he did not do either, you know, all those things that I just mentioned.
Look, this is the shoes just keep dropping. And this ties into BJ Pack, the U.S. attorney who is prosecuting this case. He is taking one scalp after another of those who have worked there and have abused the public trust to enrich themselves. And the cesspool just keeps getting discovered as deeper and deeper than we ever knew. This isn't the end, folks. This is not the end, and that's why we got to keep that city jail open as a halfway house for former City Hall employees.
Very quickly, turmoil is not new to the Atlanta School Board, and we should point out very quickly also that the Atlanta School Board holds WABE's broadcast license. But in the battle internally over whether or not to renew Superintendent Maria Karstarfin's contract, Theron, this is not going to end with the eventual fate of the superintendent. This is a board that is divided at a time when the school system is trying to move forward.
So let's kind of go back a second. And that's one of the things I like to do, is to help our listeners understand how we got to this point. So when Superintendent Maria Karstarfin's contract was removed, it was 6 board members who voted to renew the contract. There were three who voted no. So you knew you had a superintendent coming into the next phase of her contract with only 2/3 of her board, which, by the way, is her employer, who basically determines whether or not she gets extended or not, supported her. Now what we've seen, Dennis, which is really kind of different than what we've seen before, is that this superintendent is spent an enormous amount of time going around the city and promoting a lot of good things that she's done for the district. The thing that's kind of missing in all that, Dennis, is majority of these successes, if not all, but I'll just say majority, would not be possible if it was not for this board. This board has basically giving her the leeway to go out and to try to accomplish something. They had confidence in her ability to do so. The one thing I want to say is this, though. I do think that this is a perfect opportunity for our listeners to realize that there has been some progress made in APS, right? But let's also remember APS had hit rock bottom. And so any progress that was made was going to be made anyway because it had really gotten to a very, very bad point under the previous superintendent. So I believe that this board, they need to have a strategy in place that involves the community, that involves these principals and these students and these parents to really thoroughly explain what the next steps are.
The AJC had a story this week about how short superintendents, particularly in large urban districts, mm-hmm. their tenures are pretty short. And Maria did inherit a dumpster fire. There's no doubt about it. One of the worst scandals in education history in our state with the answer
the
changes.
The cheating scandal. Under, yes.
And anybody who comes in and they are a change agent, and if they've got the right personality for to be a change agent, they're not going to last long. Change agents by nature are headbutters, and they are people who aren't afraid to step on other folks' turfs. They're not afraid to take on battles that are politically unpopular. And you make enemies along the way. You may make some significant changes. You may reset the course of the institution you're working for in the right direction, but you're not going to last long. Change agents have short lifespans, and I think that Karstarfin would consider herself a change agent. So I don't think that's just about her. I think that's true of many people who are university presidents, who are mayors, county commissioners, or school superintendents.
I would have thought that through this whole change agent process, you would have spent a little bit more time with your board members who, again, vote to extend your contract or not to make sure that they are a part of this change agent strategy. And I think what is going to probably come out is, was Maria Karstarfin made aware that it was a strong possibility in this process that her contract may not be renewed? Is this sort of causing some of this reaction to go out and say, hey, look at me, look at all the great things that I'm doing?
I do think change had to happen. And I think that one thing that she needed to be leery of, given that she is an employee of a board,
right,
is she often wanted to be her own. She had her own brand. And she would get out in front of issues sometimes and give her opinions. And that's tricky when there's a board of nine that is employing you, because your opinions may not be theirs. And so that can be a really tricky path to follow.
It's a catch-22, isn't it? Because they hired her to implement a turnaround plan and to come up with that turnaround plan. And then when the turnaround plan comes out, there's questions of, well, you went to outside agencies too much. You're risking privatization in the view of some of the board members. That's a catch-22 for somebody who's brought in to make changes.
But was it too much? You know, I think that's what you're getting at. Like, because for her to do some of those things, like, look, the board allowed her to do some of those things. I think over time, though, Dennis, and let's just bring up a sore subject, which is where I made my comment. And this whole whether or not to get the deeds from the current mayor, the Gulch, and negotiations mm-hmm. with that, did she go too far on that? I mean,
was the dispute with the city over City holding some school board property, which was eventually resolved, but it wasn't without a whole lot of bumping around.
But I have said, I started off my comments, I think that Maria Karstarfin has done some good things for the school system. I think that she has been a change agent. I think, how did she manage her relationships with the public, and how did she manage her relationships with the board? I think that's what we're going to have to really figure out.
Speaking of schools, very quickly as we go, different kind of school activity at the University of Georgia, Brian. It's going to be Dooley Field at Sanford Stadium. That's going to be quite something, naming the field after legendary coach Vince Dooley. And in the city, how about them Panthers? Georgia State taking on a Southeast Conference school on the gridiron and beating Tennessee 38-30. A school in just its 10th year of football.
You know, people still talk about Appalachian State beating Michigan. Ann Arbor a decade ago or more. And so this is going to be one of those that gets talked about in embarrassing fashion for Tennessee for a long time. I know as a dog fan, I'm supposed to pull for the conference for the SEC when it's not
when
the
it
dogs.
It doesn't involve Georgia, yeah.
But I couldn't do that. I had to be loyal to the state of Georgia. And it was unadulterated joy to watch them, as Larry Munson would say, crush their noses with a hobnail boot.
The thing that I want to say about the Georgia State program, and we just pointed out, I mean, this is a 10-year-old program, is they have been doing a great job of recruiting. If you look at that roster, mm-hmm. it's made up of a lot of Georgia athletes, a lot of high school students who chose to go to Georgia State or maybe went somewhere else and came back. And then there's also a lot of Florida athletes there, too. And so Georgia State has never really had a problem with recruiting. Great opportunity for the program. And I'm hearing that it's $950,000 that the school is going to receive for, I guess, being invited and defeating the SEC team. And so I hope that money goes towards some good scholarships over there for some students and stuff like that.
And that is it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, public affairs and government consultant, and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Guys, thanks so much. This has been fun.
See you at Dooley Field. Go Dawgs.
Go Dawgs.
And if you like this show, subscribe, please. And you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. That is a great way to make sure other people can find us. We'll be back in your feed and in your head real soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.